From the ACLU, this is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seismeyer, your host. On April 17th, students at Columbia University set up an encampment to show support for Palestinians and to demand the university divest from its business related to or within Israel as a form of anti-war protest. In the weeks since its inception, the protest movement has spread, with encampments set up on over 100 college and university campuses worldwide.
Student protests over Israel's war in Gaza and U.S. involvement continue across campuses nationwide. Hundreds have been arrested so far. Even as the school year comes to an end, administrators are struggling with how to respond.
Divest! We will not stop! We will not rest! Shame on you! Who runs Columbia?
But as these protests continue, we've watched university leadership and campus and local law enforcement meet these demonstrators with a disturbing response. In the last several weeks, over 2,000 people have been arrested or detained on campuses across the country. Students and faculty have faced arrest, criminal charges, suspensions, and excessive use of force from police. This comes alongside the ongoing threats to, and in some cases, the complete suspension of, chapters of pro-Palestinian organizations like Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace on campuses nationwide. Universities have long been a site of protest, particularly anti-war protest, and a safe space for students, faculty, and staff to freely express themselves in the exchange of ideas. As these protests continue, our ACLU affiliates are keeping a pulse on campus demonstrations, advocating for students' rights and keeping universities accountable when they act with disproportionate and inequitable discipline. So, on this episode of At Liberty, we're bringing you dispatches from our affiliate staff at the New York Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of Massachusetts, and the ACLU of Michigan. They'll share what they're seeing on the ground and the legal concern and action being taken at this time. Together, we can pave a way forward that protects activism at our nation's academic institutions and beyond. We'll start our dispatches in New York, where this movement began. A lot has happened since Columbia students set up their encampment. Several universities across the states have followed their lead, and the events continue to change rapidly. Twice in the same month, Columbia University President Nemat Shafik called in the NYPD to forcibly remove students from protesting, both inside a school building and on school grounds. Images and videos from campus show a police force armed with guns, riot gear, and helmets storming the campus. Recent reports from the NYPD confirmed that an officer accidentally shot fire inside a university building. Hearing all of this, the immediate question that comes to our mind is, did we need to get here?
I mean, the short answer to did we need to get here is absolutely not. And actually, history told us that we didn't need to get here. History, you know, within Columbia's campus specifically, and across campuses in New York colleges and universities, it is quite horrific that it has gotten to this point.
That's Veronica Salama from the New York Civil Liberties Union.
I'm a staff attorney, part of a smaller committee that has been primarily handling the various intakes that we've received as it relates to speech issues and discrimination and police protests regarding the ongoing violence in Palestine.
Veronica chatted with us about tracking and monitoring these protests, the decisions made by university leadership, and the legal actions our New York affiliate has taken in response. I want to talk about Columbia specifically for a second. When did we see the escalation by administration at Columbia in particular? Because I think for folks who have perhaps don't live in New York City, who are just kind of tuning in to the news, I think it can feel like everything happened so quickly, and I think it did. But Where did this kind of begin?
We saw this larger moment very, very early on. For folks' context, you know, we right now, the NYCLU is representing two student organizations at Columbia University, Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. And we are suing Columbia University because of its suspension of these two student groups back in November. And we're suing in New York State court because we are alleging that the suspensions here violated all of Columbia's existing longstanding policies and procedures as it relates to investigating and disciplining student groups. We also saw the administration rewrite its own policies in a way that its own shared governance structures have subsequently said this violated all of our existing procedures for amending policies, but they did so with the specific purpose to contain these students' activism and to discipline them in ways that have been extremely contrary to, you know, their past practice. So early on, we've seen extreme pressure on universities to disband SJP, for example, right? There's the ACLU lawsuit against University of Florida for doing just that. And that extreme pressure came from donors, it came from alumni, it came from inside of the university. And we saw those extreme tactics happening at Columbia. And then we also are seeing it now through congressional tactics and the congressional hearing that just took place where that committee was questioning President Manoush Shafiq of Columbia University.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it does seem like the writing was a little bit on the wall as you describe the kind of environment that we are now kind of nationally witnessing at Columbia had been brewing for quite some time. I wonder how you all kind of monitor an unfolding situation like this, specifically in this last week or so, as things have really heated.
Yeah, we have many different avenues of sort of monitoring and engaging with these issues. So NYCLU has our protest monitoring program, and we have had our organizers and our protest monitors very much on the ground at all of these different campuses where we've seen, you know, the student activism pop up. And we've also seen threats of NYPD involvement and then actual NYPD arrest and violent actions. We also have different organizational connections. So we've been speaking with public defenders offices and other nonprofits that are looking at different situations. For example, like Barnard suspending all of the students that were participating in the encampment and then immediately evicting them from housing. And so we've been communicating with some organizations that are very concerned about that. And we also have our citywide protest settlement that the city actually just signed and has been very brazenly violating and ignoring. And so we have very many mechanisms to sort of monitor that as well.
Yeah, it's a really complicated situation. And also, you have so many universities just in the city of New York, where a lot of this student activism is taking place. I want to talk a little bit more about what you think about the way that this activism has been framed and how the framing has impacted the response. In response to the Columbia president's testimony at the House hearing on anti-Semitism, the NYACLU released a statement saying, "Combating anti-Semitism is critical, but the House committee is weaponizing that cause for a McCarthyite political agenda. Committee leaders are using their powers to chill pro-Palestine advocacy and views they don't like by conflating them with hate and intimidation." This seems like a wider spread problem than just at Congress. What is important to keep in mind here, and how can we stand against both anti-Semitism while also for free speech and against use of force all at once, which I think is more than possible? How have you all been seeking to convey that message?
I think that it is so important to look at the students that are engaging in the activism that they are engaging in and listen to the reasons that they say they are engaging in it and their purpose for doing it. Because we have as I mentioned, we are representing Jewish Voice for Peace, a student group at Columbia University. And one of our clients is himself a Jewish student and a member of JVP, and says that it is because of his Judaism that he is engaging in this protest. He is engaging in this because it is important to him, and it is a way that he lives out his faith. And we are also representing Students for Justice in Palestine, and the student group specifically at Columbia University. And one of our clients, who is a member of that student group, is Palestinian. And she has said that this is so important to me for so many reasons, because this is my people, and this is our U.S. money allowing for these atrocities to happen. And so we have seen sort of a lot of centering of external voices, a lot of centering of people who are not close to the issue, and just very little centering on the actual humanity and in many ways, a lot of the beauty of the activism that we are seeing on campus, because we are seeing it bring together so many students. We have seen the media play into the stereotypes and the sort of racist and stereotypical inclinations that many people carry when it comes to Palestinians, Arabs, those who advocate for Palestinians, because even in the way that we see the media describe people's actions, it is so loaded with this assumption of inherent violence, of inherent danger. So we have to ask ourselves, what is it about this issue in particular that colleges and universities feel that they can or actually must ignore all of their other very important principles of free expression, of academic freedom, of non-discrimination?
I appreciate you being willing to say the thing, because I think that is the prevailing question. What is it about this, and what about this subject matter is something that compels the university to take an entirely different route here? What is the New York Civil Liberties Union doing right now to prepare for the upcoming weeks? Where are all of your heads at?
In terms of figuring out our next steps forward, right now we're engaging in an ongoing litigation against Columbia University because of the unlawful suspension of its two student groups, Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. And the Columbia University has filed a motion to dismiss, and we are preparing our reply. And then in terms of a broader advocacy, we're continuing to have our protest monitors on the ground, monitoring the issues that are taking place, ensuring that people understand their rights and that the NYPD is held accountable when they violate people's rights. And then we're also working with the Common Interest Council to try to determine, how can we act? How can we use the settlement agreement right now to hold the city and the NYPD accountable? I think we're at a really critical juncture. I hope this doesn't become a situation where years from now we learn from it and we tout it as this incredible student activism that withstood the forces of institutions, because we have seen that happen before. We have seen student activism be honored and held up in a way that, when it was happening in real time, was being surveilled, policed, villainized. And I think that we are at a point where we can still avoid letting that happen by engaging intentionally right now. When a student group or students collectively put together what they are calling a Gaza solidarity encampment, ask them why they are doing that. Ask them, what is their cause? Why do they feel that it is so important to engage in this right now? And also hold institutions accountable when they ignore their students' rights, when they ignore their own established policies, when they succumb to pressures that are external, that are not supposed to guide their principles. I think we can do all of those things right now in a way that avoids repeating history in a harmful way.
In order to avoid repeating history, school administrators should be invested in creating discourse with students, de-escalating tensions, and doing everything possible to avoid calling the police, says Jen Rolnick-Borchetta, Deputy Project Director on Policing in the Criminal Law Reform Project at ACLU National. We spoke to Jen about the dangers present when police are called to campus.
School leaders should be thinking before they call the police whether they have created a space for safe and free expression for all students. They should be thinking about the importance of creating a space for student expression. They also have an obligation to keep campuses safe from discriminatory harassment, while at the same time ensuring that there's space for disagreement and there's space even for opinions that many might find offensive. And they also need to be considering the risk of calling the police that creates harm for students, because there's documentation about this that's important for school leaders to keep in mind in trying to keep students safe and also free to express themselves. We know that over the last 10 years, police have shot and killed about 1,000 people a year. And we know that from the Washington Post police shooting database. In that same time, we know from a recent AP investigation that police have killed about 1,000 people when they were not using lethal force, when they were misusing tactics on unarmed people who presented no safety risk. We know from Department of Justice investigations in city after city after city that there is a pattern of police using excessive force against Black, Latine, and Indigenous people, both more force and more excessive force. So this is a modern problem that we have extensive evidence that this is a risk to students. And so administrators need to be mindful that when they call in the police, it presents that risk to students.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to your point, we have the evidence to show that there is such a risk. You know, one thing that strikes me is that we haven't necessarily defined the difference between use of force and excessive use of force and what we really mean when we talk about those terms. Do you have a way to explain that to folks who just might not be familiar as much as we are with these conversations around policing?
Police use of force can include anything from pepper spray, which we've seen used on students across the country, to handcuffs, to taking someone forcefully to the ground. These are all uses of force. Whether they're allowed by the law is usually a question of what's reasonable in the moment for police. And that question includes facts like, is this person in front of the police a threat at that moment to police or others? And police are required to think about that before they apply any force. And so in each situation, while it's fact-based, at the same time, because of the risks that the use of police force can lead to significant harm, even when police aren't intending it, the goal should be to use force as little as possible and the least amount of force possible in all situations. Policing student protests shouldn't be a game of gotcha, and it shouldn't be that the school is looking to be as aggressive as possible. It should instead be about maintaining a safe space for free expression.
Yeah, absolutely. So across these college campuses, we're seeing a lot of similarities in the nature of law enforcement involvement and the justifications being used for the arrest of protesters. I'm wondering, do you think charging students and faculty with trespassing is justified? And what instead should university officials or police be doing at these protests if they should be there at all?
Whether a particular arrest is justified will depend on circumstances. Especially, we have to remember there are differences between private and public schools, and students have different rights there that are important to keep in mind.
The elephant in the room with these protests is that colleges and universities are governed by different laws and policies that are largely dependent on what state you live in and whether you attend a public or private university. Making it more complicated is that civil disobedience, like encampments and occupying buildings, is often not protected conduct. What students at any academic institution have rights to is an environment that is safe, free from harassment or violence, thanks to Title VI laws that require the university to not discriminate based on race, color, or national origin, and to protect their students from harassment equitably. Carol Rose, the executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts, says while this can present a tension, it is possible for schools to get this right.
It's important, especially when it's controversial, especially when it's difficult, that these rules are applied with an even hand and that what's good for one side is also good for the other.
I think that one of the issues is that a lot of students really don't know their rights, and particularly students that are attending private universities, which aren't protected by the First Amendment and therefore are then held to university policy as opposed to receiving that kind of like broader federal protection. What are other elements of federal policy that we have to take into account here? I know that there's been a lot of discussion about Title VI complaints. Even at private universities, students need to be kept free from harassment or intimidation. What can you say about all of these different dynamics of what is a student right to protest and to speech, and then conversely to safety, freedom from safety and harassment at a private institution in specific?
Right. So Title VI is a federal law that bans any entity that receives federal financial assistance, which is most private and public universities, from discriminating on the basis of race or color or national origin. And it has to be applied, however, with consistency to the First Amendment. And at the same time, they have to ensure that there's access to free speech requirements. Private university is covered by the First Amendment, but they may be covered by state law or state constitutional law, like in Massachusetts, where our free speech under the state constitution is more expansive than under the federal constitution. But in any event, you know, it's really important that when you have these investigations of anti-Semitism or anti-Muslim or anti-Israeli or anti-Palestinian or anti-Arab environments, I mean, there's all flavors of this, right? It's really important that the U.S. Department of Education, when they do these investigations, their Office for Civil Rights, that they do this and they resolve the complaints of students who say that they're subjected to a hostile learning environment or being discriminated against, that they do so with an eye toward also making sure that there's a fair application and a non-discriminatory application of rights of association and rights of freedom of speech. And so it comes down to sort of a fairness balancing. And the most important thing to keep in mind is that a university can't say, well, we're going to apply this one policy to one group because of their viewpoint and not to other groups because of their viewpoint. So that's where the ACLU comes in, is to try to make sure that both the Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education, when doing Title VI investigations, as well as the university and college administrators, are applying whatever rules they have with an equal hand and without discrimination based on the viewpoint.
That makes a lot of sense. So we've seen Harvard University in the headlines throughout the anti-war student protest movement. Just a couple of weeks ago, we saw Harvard suspend the student group Palestine Solidarity Committee, to which the ACLU of Massachusetts responded with a letter asking the group to immediately be reinstated. Why was this important for you all to weigh in on?
Well, the Palestine Solidarity Committee is the only recognized pro-Palestinian student organization at Harvard College. And this probation was imposed on the group as a predicate for then a suspension of the PSC for the remainder of the spring 2024 term. And so the ACLU of Massachusetts were representing the Palestine Solidarity Committee for the limited purpose of the issues arising from this probation. And what we're alleging is that Harvard put them on probation and then suspended them based on sort of vague and shifting policies that basically limit their association with other groups. And rights of association are really important under the Constitution and under the law in general. And so it's important to ensure that campus policies like this are applied to all groups fairly and consistently and without regard to their viewpoint.
If I can dig in a little bit more here, what was Harvard College claiming that the Palestine Solidarity Group had done to violate campus policy?
So one of the things that they alleged was that they had co-sponsored events as an official Harvard group, that they co-sponsored events with groups that weren't official Harvard groups, simply by announcing that there were going to be events coming up, such as demonstrations or protests or things like that. And first, it's not at all clear that things like spontaneous or rapid response protests and demonstrations are really qualify as events under the Harvard policy. And there's a whole separate policy having to do with protests and demonstrations that are a different policy. So suddenly sort of conflating between events and protests was the first problem. And then the second, they kept changing the rules when they talked to the students from the Palestine Solidarity Committee, you know, first saying that you can't have a logo and then later saying, well, you can't even talk about it, or you have to officially say that you're not affiliated with this upcoming protest or things like that. And so because it was, the rules seemed to be both vague and shifting and changing over time, and not even at all clear that they should be applying to these demonstrations and protests, we basically are concerned that it kind of constitutes a breach of contract and certainly violates Harvard's duty to provide just basic fairness in their disciplinary proceedings. There may also be other concerns raised on, like, free speech and rights of association. So we raised all of those and tried to open a line of communication with the college, and we're hopeful that we'll still be able to have that communication.
That's really interesting. Do you think that the rise in public pressure on universities like Harvard is the reason behind Harvard, the administration's kind of waffling in their messaging towards these kind of student groups?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really hard when we see what happens with Congress calling in these university presidents to be grilled for, you know, 5-6 hours at a time, and they're trying to figure out how to respond. And so I think the events are changing rapidly on the ground, and I think it's important that while we respect the fact that the universities and colleges are under a lot of pressure, it's important that this is the moment where we stand firm in our commitment to free speech, freedom of association, and a fair application of the rules.
When it comes to applying the rules, most universities have looked to law enforcement to get the job done, which has in turn worsened the situation. But what happens when we keep police at a distance and let these protests continue? Here we can look to Michigan for a lesson.
What I've seen can really only be characterized in two words. One is peaceful and the other is organized. I think what we've seen is hundreds of students at the University of Michigan come together and organize protest after protest in different places, both indoors and outdoors. We luckily have not seen the type of escalation we've seen at other colleges, both public and private, around the country.
That's Ramis Wadud, a staff attorney for the ACLU of Michigan. He says the calm tenor of the protests across the state's college campuses is unique. This is in due part to the fact that most of the state's large universities are public and bound by the First Amendment. It's through the Constitution, Ramis says, that the ACLU of Michigan has been able to hold universities accountable to its policies amid the demonstrations. Last month, the affiliate sent a letter to the University of Michigan to do exactly that.
The university in late March hosted what's called the Honors Convocation, kind of a celebration for students and their families who made the honor roll or received some sort of honors from the university. Students held a protest during the convocation and really took attention away from the convocation itself. Now, you know, in our eyes, you know, looking at the last few months, that was really a culmination of months of protests that happened around campus. But in response to this specific protest, the university president sent an email to the university community saying that the disruption at the honors convocation was inappropriate and unacceptable, and that they were announcing a draft policy that would, you know, add on to the number of policies that they already have, which would essentially ban all disruptions on campus. We're not even talking about protests. We're talking about disruptions in general. The policy itself did not incorporate any nuance or specifics or constitutional requirements in terms of balancing the rights to free speech and protest of community members with the necessity of university administrators to ensure that university operations continue without substantial disruptions. So in response to that draft policy, You know, luckily, the university welcomed public comments on the draft policy. And in response to that invitation, the ACLU of Michigan, given the strong constitutional concerns we saw with the policy, we wrote a letter to the university essentially saying that the draft policy, if it's adopted the way it is, would be unconstitutionally vague, overbroad. We published it so that the university community and the public could see where we were coming from. And it seems like the university took our concerns and the concerns of hundreds of other community members who gave public comments. In fact, the university president followed up with another message to the community saying, we are listening, we're taking your concerns to heart. And I think really that was the moment where it clicked, where we need a different approach to student protests.
That's really interesting. And it really is quite different than what we've seen across the country. It does seem very notable to me that the University of Michigan has really engaged in dialogue with both student protesters and, as you mentioned, community members, external organizations, etc.
Well, you know, my hope is that the university, they have finally, you know, come to the point where they're going to allow protests to continue without significantly disrupting those protests. But I think that is a lesson learned by the university, because back in November, students organized a pretty large protest outside of a school administrative building that was hosting a meeting of the university regents, which are the elected officials that help to run the university. And at that protest, there was a significant police presence, not only from the university police, but a number of local municipal police departments with 50 plus, I think it was, police cars. A couple of students were arrested, and not even at the protest, but days after the protest, you know, police came and found them and arrested them on suspicion of being involved in whether it was trespass or breaking and entering or something else. So we saw a huge police crackdown, a hugely inappropriate police crackdown back in November. And what we're seeing now is a complete change of pace, a complete change of tone by the university. And so we're glad to see it, although it took some time for the university to get there.
I mean, it does sound proof possible that some of these other universities who are engaging in ways that we see to be excessive, that they can actually change their tune. They can actually take a different path. It does seem like that is the lesson out of the University of Michigan, at least at this point.
So I think other universities can learn a lot from the University of Michigan's approach to their encampment, which is a pretty common sense lesson, which is let the encampment continue and keep the police at a distance. The University of Michigan is kind of taking the opposite extreme approach to these encampments, where you see schools like Columbia, where within 24 hours, the university president is calling in the NYPD to clear the encampment. At the University of Michigan, you're seeing a completely hands-off approach where the encampments have been allowed to continue. There hasn't been much or any direct contact between the students and the administration. And while that is a good thing for speech and protest, the encampments have been allowed to continue without fear of them being torn down or limited. I worry that it's too far in the extreme, where really the purpose of speech is to create dialogue. But I don't think we've gotten the reciprocity yet. And so I think if the university and if the regents really want to take a respectful and speech-supportive approach to these protests, they will actually engage in that dialogue. And we saw that pretty early on at Michigan State University, a little further north, where students set up an encampment. And I think the day of, the morning of even, the university president and a couple other administrators actually went and visited the encampment. And, you know, I don't think the students were satisfied with the outcome of that conversation, but protest is no longer in the form of an encampment. But I believe those conversations are still going on up in Lansing. And so I really think dialogue and hearing each other out is the only solution to this. And so, you know, Columbia's approach of calling in the NYPD twice at this point is definitely not the right approach. And the university's approach is definitely better, but I think it could be even better if it's a two-way conversation instead of just one-way.
Thanks so much to Veronica Salema, Jen Rolnick-Borchetta, Carol Rose, and Ramis Wadud for joining us. And thanks to you for listening. If you want to learn more about the ACLU's response to the rise in anti-war student protests and the increased police presence on college campuses nationwide, check out our links in the description box below. There, you can find a place to report any violations pertaining to the student anti-war protest movement, along with some other resources to consider. The open letter we at the ACLU wrote to college and university presidents urging them to protect student protest and keep all students safe from harassment or discrimination, and some other helpful materials for students looking to know their rights. Until next week, stay strong. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seismeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by Carrie Daniels.